What's up? Happy opening week. It's JS Talk Plus. We're back, kind of. I'm Blake Murphy. Joining me today and for the entire season this year is Julia Kreutz. Julia, hi.
Hello. It's so nice to be here with you across from you at a table where there is not a beer in front of us.
I would prefer a beer.
Kind of different, I will say. There's coffee instead of beer, but so happy to be here with you today and for the rest of the season as well.
The only two beverages, coffee and beer. So for anyone who missed the announcement on social media from Sports.PR, Julia is joining JS Talk Plus full time. We will talk about that a little bit more. And Julia's been a guest of the show for years, so the audience is likely familiar with her, but we will get into that more on April 15th when we launch officially. This is a podcast only edition to get us ready for opening week here. A lot of Blue Jays roster decisions to go through. On opening day, March 27th, we will be on live 11 to 12 on Sportsnet Plus, Sportsnet 360, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, in place of the Raptor show. But I'm still doing Raptor show up until April 14th. Then on the 15th, we'll start officially. We'll do like a more proper welcome for you, Julia. Balloons and coffees and beers and all the accoutrement.
Nothing less. Thank you very much.
So it is opening week. Jays are back in action on Thursday. Very, very, very excited. It's also the week of like I managed my fantasy baseball schedule poorly, where I have four drafts in a 3-day span, including one with the guest who's going to join us for the first segment today, Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of At the Letters. We had, Julia, get this. Ben's, so what, year 17?
Year 17, yes.
Year 17 of Ben's like home fantasy baseball
right
league. I am an expansion team this year. Did an expansion draft and everything.
Are you ready for the responsibility that comes with something like, because this is the league of tradition.
That's true. Now we're breaking tradition. There's a whole format change. There's new teams in the mix. And I have to say, Blake, I mean, we really stacked the odds against you and the other new team to the point that, okay, so Julia, like Blake couldn't even have access to such MLB stars as like Brandon Nimmo.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
That was like the level of player that was not available to him. So I do feel kind of bad looking at, you know, just how much the odds were stacked. But you know what? A good GM loves a good challenge. I'm sure that Blake and the other newcomer Nathan will be up to the task, and we'll see where it all leads here.
And listen, you have 17 years to make this work, Blake.
Yeah, I have 17 years to figure it out. Yeah, no, Brandon Nimmo is a tough line to draw. Christopher Sanchez. This is the level of like my first expansion pick was Christopher Sanchez,
Who
terrific actual baseball pitcher, not a particularly high end fantasy pitcher because there's not a lot of strikeouts. This is the situation we're dealing with here.
Ezekiel Tovar was not available to you. You know, a Sonny Gray. I mean, these are pretty good players, but they're not exactly the Bobby Witt Juniors and Aaron Judges of the world.
Yes, they are the guys that we will be talking about like week 7 of the show when we're playing, the Jays are playing the Orioles for like the 19th time already. Then we'll get to know, hey, let's really dig in on Heston Kjerstad. Right. We'll dig in Cade Povich. We'll get to know those names. They're not opening week level names. Opening week level names are Aaron Judge and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Ryan Yarbrough, apparently, the buzziest name on opening week. So here's the right now for the show. We're going to go through with Ben and welcome, Ben. Thanks for joining us now that the fantasy chats aside. We are going to go through some of these decisions the Blue Jays had to make this week around their final roster for opening day. Some of them will be pretty inconsequential as guys get back from injury. Some of them pretty telling about their plans. We also have an Alejandro Kirk extension to talk about. We do not have a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. extension to talk about as of 12:16 on Tuesday. We'll see if that changes in the next little bit. And then we'll go around the AL East and kind of shape that up as well. So starting point, I'll keep it open end of the start. Julia, when the roster decisions come down over the weekend, anything stand out to you as surprising or unexpected at all?
Yeah, spoke to a show a little bit about it over the weekend on Jay's Talk, but Addison Barger not making this team was one that honestly surprised me maybe a little bit more than the other moves, just because of the spring that he had and, you know, the ability to slide into corner outfield positions as well as play third base. I thought he had the inside track, and I know that we haven't seen a ton of production when the games actually matter from Barger. He very much struggled last year, kind of seemed to figure something out later on. Overall, so far, we haven't seen a ton from Barger in the majors, but it seemed like with the strides that he made that he would get another chance here early on. And that just didn't happen. You hear John Schneider, what he's saying about playing time, about making sure that Barger stays consistent and he continues to work on these betterments that we saw in spring training. And that comes with, obviously, regular at-bats, regular playing time, which is something that the Blue Jays could not promise him in the major leagues. But that would be the one that sort of caught me a little bit more off guard. Obviously, on the pitching side, there were a couple of eyebrow raisers as well. I don't know where you guys stand on that, and if I'm the only one that's maybe as surprised by Barger as I am.
No, I have an easy explanation for the Barger one. It's that someone has to calibrate the Statcast machines in Buffalo, and the exit velocity and arm speed guy is the guy to do it. No, it is interesting the way you lay it out. A 1.162 OPS over 35 plate appearances in spring training. So did as much as he could at the plate to make the case that he should be on the roster. Now the everyday playing time thing is interesting, and I think it tells us something positionally about how they're thinking of him as well, because it looks like Will Wagner and Ernie Clement are going to be something close to a platoon at third base, which pushes Barger more to a corner outfield. And it was Alan Roden, another lefty prospect, who took that roster spot. Now, Roden wasn't on the 40-man, so Barger actually had that working in his favor, too, of, you know, hey, Roden, maybe you don't have to burn an option yet. If he does get sent down, you don't have to clear a 40-man spot. Ben, in your eyes, did it come down to a Barger-Roden decision, or was this more about Will Wagner having a good camp?
I think there's all kinds of layers to it, and all those would have contributed. But yeah, for me, it probably would be Roden who's the biggest surprise, just to see him on the team. Obviously, he had a great spring. And so once he performed to that level, then he put himself on an inside track to be able to make the team. But if you had asked 6-7 weeks ago, I definitely wouldn't have predicted that Alan Roden would be on this baseball team, potentially, you know, making some starts. Like, I think we'll probably see him in their opening day and probably for a bunch of the weekend, maybe with the exception of your boy Cade Povich, who's a lefty. But, you know, I think that there's probably a lot of run for a Roden here.
Yeah, it's interesting, Ben, because 100%, we didn't expect Roden to be here. It is certainly in the start of camp. But then Ross Atkins sort of singles him out, right, as a player to watch, which is something that we haven't seen Atkins do a whole bunch of. And that sort of happens. The spotlight is on him. He produces, but you still sort of, you know, you have in the back of your head the fact that this front office has been conservative with prospects in the past and sort of keeping them in AAA for a little bit to start the season. And then they get that chance a little bit later on. And so, you know, once Roden started putting up the numbers that he did, you sort of expect him to at least be in that conversation. But the way that it happened, it was pretty fast. And it seems like this has been sort of the case for Roden throughout his minor league career as well. Everything that he has done has been very steady. And it seems like he never looks back, right? He's always really looking for the next thing and bettering himself and then just staying or evolving. And that has been pretty, pretty impressive to see.
Yeah. And I think he's 25 at this point. Like, right. Let's see what he can do. And the similar logic applies to Barger. I'm sure he'll be up at some point this season. But you know, at a certain point, if these guys can help, I would say with Aroldis too, he's probably got to prove it a little bit more after the suspension. But the Jays need every win they can get. They're not going to make the playoffs with a 7-game lead. They're not going to miss the playoffs probably by 7 games. So it's going to be close. You need those little marginal runs if you can get them.
Do you see a signal in that decision when it comes to Roden? Because this front office has been very years of control oriented, manage the 40-man depth oriented. The fact that look, and the Roden thing could only be for a couple weeks. We'll see when Dalton Varsho's back, how that shakes out with Miles Straw and Nathan Lucas or whatever. Obviously, if Roden hits, he's going to stay. But there's potential here. Hey, Roden's here for 2 or 3 weeks, and you use the 40-man spot, and you use the option year early. Obviously, we all know this is a very high-leverage season where everything matters. Do you read into that part of the decision, though, that, hey, we're going to take the best roster available no matter what it means flexibility-wise?
I think it makes sense for the Jays to prioritize that right now, and I'm not shocked by it. I think that, you know, they rightfully have a reputation as being very measured, but they'll find their times to push in. And whether that was the Matt Chapman trade, you're trading away quote unquote prospects to get Matt Chapman, you know, they're pushing in that moment. This to me, obviously much smaller scale, but you're probably using that option year on Roden at some point this season anyway. So you're not really starting the option clock early. You just get him up. If he can help you, great. If not, boom, back to the minors he goes, and it'll be, you know, later this summer he gets that next chance.
Yeah, and look, again, if he hits, he's going to stay. He's a lefty, so even if you worry a little bit about lefty on lefty stuff, you're on the strong side of a platoon. So we'll see how that side of it shakes out. Julia, with respect to Barger at AAA, what would you be looking for? Like, obviously, the biggest way he's going to get an opportunity is someone at the major league level gets hurt or struggles. Yeah. But what do you like? What's a signpost for you when he goes back down there?
Yeah, it's do more of what you did in the spring. I don't think that there is really any secret here, and it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, Blake, where it's just roster construction, right? It's really not about Barger or where he is with his hitting right now. It's just this is what the Blue Jays believe to be the best possible roster for opening day. Now, say Will Wagner struggles. Well, then even though this is supposed to be a platoon situation at third base, if he's struggling, then you need to reconsider and think about the fact that, okay, if you really want the best roster to be on the field, then maybe it's time to consider bringing Addison Barger back and forgetting this whole platoon situation, which I'm still not entirely sure or convinced that is the best move for third base for the Jays, just because of what we saw with Ernie Clement last year when he had the opportunity to play every day and just how well he produced in that setting. So maybe, I'm not sure, but maybe this is Clement's position, and when the matchups make sense, we will see Will Wagner at third, and you keep Wagner as sort of more of a bench player type of guy. These are all fascinating discussions, but when it comes to Barger, I don't think that this is really about him. If he keeps hitting like that, he will be back here eventually. That's kind of how I see it, and I am curious to hear from Ben what you think the third base situation is for the Blue Jays. Do we expect a platoon situation there?
Yeah, it's going into this season, I thought it was Ernie Clement pretty much every day. Now, with the way things are configured, Will Wagner could play a bit more third base. It seems like he's recovered well. The knee is helping him throw, because the throws were not good last year, but the knee is now helping him. So now you have the possibility of a platoon, and especially if you want Santander to be DHing, then that takes away those ABs from Will Wagner in that situation. But I do think that Santander will play the field at least half the time. So in those days, you still have DH open. That could be Springer, it could be Roden, it could be probably not Vladerbaugh from what John Schneider has said. But, you know, you certainly could put Will Wagner at DH. So I don't mind that against a righty. I don't think it'll be a strict platoon. Probably 5 days a week for Clement, 2 days a week for Wagner, something like that would be my guess.
Yeah, there's also David Schneider in the mix for those DH spots as well.
Yep.
David Schneider, to you guys, it just seemed like a bench bat at this point. I know he had a pretty solid spring. Everyone loves him, but he's coming off a pretty rough year there.
I think he could start against lefties, like against Povich, against, you know, Mackenzie Gore. You know, you have a lefty coming up in this next week. I could see Schneider starting in that scenario.
Yeah, you're not bumping Jimenez out of the starting lineup against a lefty, but certainly Roden or Lucas or Will Wagner, if it's Will Wagner in there, could take the down day against lefties, which would open up a spot then for Ernie Clement if he's not already in there, and then potentially David Schneider. There's also Miles Straw in there, although I kind of feel like... okay, let's do this one. So Miles Straw and Nathan Lucas both make the opening day roster. In part because Dalton Varsho is out. And logically, Dalton Varsho out means there's one spot for someone. Kind of feels like Dalton Varsho being out kept both of these guys on the roster, where there's now a lefty and a righty. You can mix and match there if you want to. I don't know that Miles Straw is going to hit against anyone, but we'll see. The other scenario is it's Nathan Lucas's job for right now, and Miles Straw is in like the Bradley Zimmer, Daniel Vogelbach, like you come in the eighth inning of two games a week. Julia, what would your read be on the center field usage until Varsho's back?
Yeah, we were talking about surprising decisions. It kind of surprised me to see both guys make this roster. I think your analysis makes a lot of sense, Blake, which is this is very much a situation in which the Blue Jays are giving themselves a little bit more options to mix and match and to have a reliable center fielder that can still give you some offense. And how do you maximize that offense, right? Well, you get a lefty and a righty, and you play the matchups a little bit. But when Dalton Varsho returns, then what does the future hold for both of those guys? I don't know. I mean, the Blue Jays are very, very high on Miles Straw's defense, and we know that. And you know, whether that is just discourse and whether that is reality.
There's a thing called sunk cost fallacy, and it's you already paid $11 million in a failed move on a guy. I don't know if you need to chase that with good money. Straw's also interesting because, like, again, like I'm being a little facetious in that I don't think he'll like will he hit against righties at all, but like he has not had a WRC plus of 100 on the strong side of the platoon in since like 2021. Like yeah. he hasn't even been an average hitter yeah. with the platoon advantage.
Well, this is the thing with Straw. Like I actually like him on the roster as the 26th right final player.
Zimmer.
Exactly. And you have specialized roles for him. You need, like, let's say you're down by one and Heinemann or Kirk is on base. Boom. Pinch run. Perfect. Get him out of there with flip for the other catcher. He served his purpose. Same with late game defense. If for whatever reason you have Roden, you have maybe George Springer playing center field, you're trying to lock down a one-run lead, a two-run lead, in comes Miles Straw. That's helpful. So there's a use for him. However, when I look at his offense, just simple numbers for his career in the major leagues, per 162 games, he averages 2 home runs, 36 RBI. And I know we're past home runs and RBI, but you know, it gotta get.
I mean, his OPS is 625 and his WRC yeah. plus is 78. You if you want to use something more advanced,
it paints you a picture. This guy should not be in the starting lineup, in my opinion. Maybe, you know, sure, throw him a start every 2 weeks. That's fine. No problem with that. But if he's starting even once a week, I think would be too much.
That said, do you think he's starting center field opening day?
I would not do that if I was the Toronto Blue Jays. No. I would not. I mean, what do you guys think?
Yeah, my guess would be Lucas.
Maybe Roden.
Yeah.
Why not, right?
We have seen very little of it, but they seem to be... You never know when they're like, oh, yeah, we could stick him there. Like, I'm not going to judge off, like, 10 spring training innings or whatever, but...
Maybe they go Lucas for opening day. But, I mean, Eflin's a righty. You might want Roden in there somewhere.
Yeah. Would you not go Springer before you'd go Roden?
I would go Roden, personally.
Okay, so going for the youth and athleticism over the experience in the position, okay?
Yeah.
We did get quite a few texts over the weekend of people asking, why not Springer at center field? My answer was probably because the Blue Jays have the health concern that just hovers over Springer, and the move to right field happened for a reason, and the reason being that it's a significantly lighter workload, right, to play right.
And he made some really good plays in right field last year. Mm-hmm. Let's give him credit for that, no question about it. But being a good right fielder at age 34 is different than being a good center fielder at age 35. And yes. I just don't think you want to make that bet.
Yeah, and like in as much as we can evaluate it, he was no longer a good center fielder but at the time that they moved him off of that position. On top of which, it was also, I think we probably all got like whiplash going from like, can George Springer still handle center field to here's Kevin Kiermaier and Dalton Varsho.
Right.
And I don't know, I don't want to go back. So yeah. That's an interesting element. And then it'll be interesting as well when Varsho's back, you know, does Straw stay because the 26th man role is so limited? Does Lucas stay even though they're both lefties because they like Lucas a little better than Straw? There's also a component of, you know, Straw is getting paid. Can you get any utility out of that? Not that you want to manage that way, but if it's a difference maker at the 26th roster spot, whatever. The other interesting thing about Straw keeping him that maybe makes me think he would hang on to the 26th man role is that they did have to clear a 40-man spot for him, or they do have to. They have not done so yet. They have to actually clear 3 40-man spot because of him and Alan Roden and Richard Lovelady. No, Richard Lovelady was already added. Jacob Barnes needs a 40-man spot as well. Let's pivot to the pitching side with that. They need 3 40-man spots. I believe Adam Mackle's probably going to go on the 60-day IL to take one of them.
Yep.
Do you have a... Look, they have a bunch of... I guess Tommy Nance clears one too because he's out of options. They'll have to DFA him.
They will have to outright him to the minors. I don't think they'd have to take him off the 40-man per se. He would just have to be exposed to waivers.
Okay.
And then if he clears, he's still on the 40-man in AAA.
Okay. And then if you're going to do that and you need to clear 40-man anyway, do you just make him the DFA guy so you don't have to put multiple guys through waivers?
You could. Yeah, you could. Or you could, I mean, do you look at Easton Lucas? Do you look at Nick Robertson? I mean, how secure are their grips on
Josh
their 40-man?
Walker.
Yeah, I mean, look, at a certain point, the bottom of a 40-man roster, it's kind of designed to be cycled through. And there's no disrespect to those human beings who are trying their best, but realistically, the Jays will be fine. They can cut those guys.
Yeah, I mean, all of those guys got added late last season when they were just doing post-deadline 40-man churn anyway. Like, none of those guys are long-term Toronto Blue Jays prospects who you're getting rid of. Are you married to any of those, Julia?
I'm not. And you know, you speak about sort of 40-man roster construction and what it is that the Blue Jays are trying to accomplish here. One thing that does stick out is the fact that Ryan Yarbrough did not make this team and maybe was not considered important and an important enough piece for one of those 40-man roster spots. I'm still pretty fascinated by that decision. Ben, maybe it does indicate that the Blue Jays have trust that one, Max Scherzer is going to be okay, and two, Yairel Rodriguez can be the long man out of that pen and come in for a spot start if necessary. I have to say that just from where I'm sitting, it seemed like a little bit of a gamble here to let Yarbrough walk. And John Schneider speaking a lot about, you know, contractual things and sort of keeping it very vague when it came to that sense. But he immediately signed with the Yankees, I'm pretty sure, right?
Yes.
As soon as he left the
yes.
Blue Jays.
And for the $2 million he was going to get from the Blue Jays if he made the roster.
Yeah, so that to me was pretty interesting because we are talking about bottom of the 40-man roster guys, and there are options. There are guys that can be cut here. It just, to me, it indicates maybe some faith in those guys. I don't know where you fall with that.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting too. And is it faith in the guys they do have? Is it a lack of faith in Ryan Yarbrough? I don't know. I mean, I think it's clear that the industry doesn't value him that much, and he throws 86 miles an hour, which is pretty much as slow as you're ever going to see in the upper levels of professional baseball, let alone the major leagues. You don't see that in Double A. So he does some things well, as evidenced by the fact that he was a good pitcher for 100 innings last year, but he's just never going to be that coveted, like scarce, oh my goodness, we have to do everything we can to get him type guy. I would have kept him. I think that he helps and you need length. And I think the Jays' biggest weakness is starting pitching depth. And I think that he could have helped mitigate that, which is why I like the deal in the first place, and I don't like them letting him go. Look, it's not the biggest deal in the world. It's not like the Vlad Jr. decision as far as stakes for the franchise, but on a small scale, I thought that they should have kept him. And $2 million, yeah, I get it. It's something, but if it's nothing to take on Miles Straw, then it should be nothing to take on Ryan Yarbrough's amount of money.
It's also like $2 million, like Jacob Barnes for making the roster, I believe, gets 1.4,
right?
So we're talking like there is a tax component to that, and sure, it all matters, but we're not talking about one guy was making $10 million and one guy was making the league minimum. I found it fascinating through that lens, and this is another one of those ones that like maybe it resolves itself pretty quickly, because when, you know, Eric Swanson or Zach Pop or Ryan Burr back, you know, Jacob Barnes or Richard Lovelady were probably bounced anyway. They're the next ones out. But the length is the thing, Julia, to your point, that stood out to me, where they only have one off day in the first 21 days of the season. So not only, like, let's assume Scherzer's healthy, but you're probably not pushing any of your starters 105, 110 pitches in the first couple weeks of the season. Yariel is the only guy back there that you'd probably peg to give you more than, you know, four outs probably. So it can, and you can obviously send guys up and down, but Lovelady and Barnes don't have options. You really only have Sandlin and Little who have options, and those guys figure to be like pretty safely locked in your bullpen. So you don't even have a lot of options in terms of that churn if guys are overworked or whatever. Now, again, if this works itself out, if Swanson comes back or Burr comes back, or your starting rotation is really good. But it is interesting that they're starting the season with a dense part of the schedule and a little thin on length.
To me, what kind of comes to mind hearing you lay it out like that is maybe we see someone like Jake Blas a little bit sooner than we are all anticipating, because listen, that is a brutal schedule to start the year. That is a really, really tough schedule, not a ton of days off. And, you know, there are still some question marks around one of your starters. We don't know how much the thumb soreness is going to impact a Scherzer. And sure, you have Yariel Rodriguez waiting in the pen. Is that really, do you really want him to be a back and forth type of guy again, right? Instead of really maximizing his stuff in the way that you have envisioned, you know, really letting the fastball fly and things of the sort in one inning type of role. Well, then maybe that opens a door for Jake Blas. He looked pretty good in the spring. There were a couple of moments for sure, but overall his stuff looked solid. And if he has a good start to AAA, I would maybe keep an eye on that, because, you know, to Ben's point, the depth is a little thin, but Blas does look like the guy who is next in line here.
And it's a great point. Yeah, Bloss being on the 40-man and having major league experience, maybe you don't even consider Yariel being a swingman. Maybe you just leave him in that role for certainty there if you need a sixth man, a sixth starter to spread those guys out initially in the season. We could look at the AAA depth. We could save that for another episode. I don't know that people have a lot of appetite for, hey, who's better, Dylan Tate or Josh Walker? Hey, could Easton Lucas bump Andrew Bash as the number three Bison starter? I care about all that stuff, but we can. Amir Garrett, the number one hooper in all of pro baseball, is down there somewhere
It's a Blake Murphy feature waiting to happen.
Yeah, I mean, the Jays signing the guy who played college hoops is very much for me.
Yep.
And I hope he gets called up at some point, but not until I can get him on Jays Talk Plus.
Yeah. We want a May 10th call up, give you a couple days.
Just give us the first couple weeks because we won't get him once he's up.
Raptors are out by then.
Yeah. Raptors are done on the 14th. They're not, the 13th is their last game. Yeah. So we're good there. Ben, before we let you go, the other big news this week was that Alejandro Kirk was signed to an extension, 5-year, $58 million deal that begins next year. So if you include this year, he's under contract for 6 years, $63 million, through to age 31. What was your snap reaction to that one? Other than, hey, this front office doesn't extend guys. What's going on here?
Yeah, exactly. It's a little shock to the system. Jose Berríos and Randall Grichuk, the only other extensions longer than 2 years ever done by this front office as of March 25th. As we're recording this, I'm not holding my breath on a Vlad extension, but it is technically possible. So we'll see. As for Kirk, I think that it's a good player and you want to be in the business of keeping good players around. So just baseline, it makes sense. The cost is very reasonable when you look at approximately $8 million in arbitration, then four free agent years, $12.5 million apiece. That's great. I mean, catchers don't really get paid, which is kind of shocking.
It is shocking.
Isn't it? There's a whole other podcast to be done.
The value's huge, but the attrition rate is just like too high, I think.
Yeah.
And the thing, there's also this like paradoxical line where if you are X good as a catcher, they want to move you off of catcher more often so that you can be in the line. Like, look back to Alejandro Kirk's good hitting seasons.
Right,
he played like 130 games, but he only started at catcher like 65 of them.
That's right. I mean, Bryce Harper coming up was a catcher.
Yeah.
And they moved him off of there pretty quick because his bat was just too good. So you're right. There is kind of a ceiling to how good you can be as an offensive catcher because at a certain point, you're Sal Perez, you're DHing half the time.
Yeah, Contreras this year.
Yeah, exactly. You move him to first base, boom. Then it's a whole different equation. So Kirk is kind of, he does some things really well as a catcher defensively. We're all familiar with the framing, which should still have value even in an ABS era. Should that happen? He's become a better thrower. He can handle the pitching staff. All that stuff is really good. Then you look at the hitter, able to control the strike zone to a certain extent. We all know he's slow and getting slower. So that's always going to be his, you know, shortcoming as a player. And I think in spite of that, though, there are so many things that he does well. You want him on your team, and I like this move.
The one thing that, to Blake's point, the moments in which we have seen Alejandro Kirk be really, really good offensively and really, you know, put the ball in the air with any consistency have been times when he's not catching as much, Ben. This year, it's his job, right? You have Tyler Heineman as the backup catcher, but this is not a tandem at all like it was in past years. What do you see, or what does this front office see? What do the Blue Jays see as an indicator that, you know, Kirk can handle the bulk of the catching and still be productive offensively?
Because as a note, 89 games started at catcher was a career high last year.
Yeah, and they'll definitely need more than that this year. I mean, Tyler Heineman, great guy to have around the organization. Don't want him starting 50 games.
You like magic 70 tricks? Games.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, great magic. That's awesome. But, you want Tyler Heineman starting 35 games. You know, I think that would be fine. So then you really want 125 from Kirk. That's going to impact his offense for sure. I mean, we've seen him hitting lasers in spring training. You can document it with the exit velocities. That's probably going to drop off as the season progresses, and you have to accept that. Ideally, you find another catcher somehow. I mean, it's not easy to do, but I mean, the Pirates got Joey Bart out of nowhere. Like, you know, it's not necessarily impossible.
Luke Maley's a free agent now.
Realistically, it's the Kirk show. So they need him to, produce. And I think if they even got league average production, they'd be thrilled. Like if it's a 100 WRC plus, I think you have to be thrilled with that considering just the other things that he does. But it's a lot to put on him. And he's low key one of the most important players on this team.
And if he were to get hurt now, this is the other thing. Is like, if you're going to push him to 110, 120 starts, you can be, you're still not, I don't love Tyler Heineman, Christian Betancourt, Ali Sanchez, Phil Clark being the catcher succession. But if one of those guys is just in a backup role, fine. If Alejandro Kirk were to get hurt at any point, and then one of those guys is starting every single day, and like Phil Clark's got a nice bat, I think he caught one base runner last year. You know, these other guys were like readily available. And then, yeah, there's always going to be a Sebi Zavala on the waiver wire, but none of them, the Cardinals guy they got, like Raposo?
Not they Herrera.
They had Raposo in the at AAA for a couple games last year off the waiver wire. This is how low we get in, where I can't even remember the third catcher, and that's what I live for.
Yeah.
I want the third catcher. No, it gets ugly quick if Alejandro Kirk gets hurt. So this is a pretty big bet.
Yeah. He's so important. They need to develop, acquire some more catching. You know, pitching is probably the biggest organizational hole and weakness, and that's, I think, their, you know, biggest risk factor entering this season. But yeah, like a lot of teams, pitching is kind of, you know, that's a big thing. Not a lot of teams have catching depth that they're happy with. So the Blue Jays are not unique in the fact that their catcher is super important and they would be in trouble without him. But that is definitely the case with Kirk and the Jays.
Yeah, and if you do have good catcher depth, you're not eager to trade off. I know the Blue Jays did, you know, traded Gabriel Moreno for Dalton Varsho and then traded Danny Jansen away in a lost year. But, you know, the Orioles are probably, because they have the depth at every position, but like Sammy Basalo is going to be sitting in AAA waiting for an opportunity or see if they can get him enough reps. Like, they're not going to trade that guy.
That's
right. They're going to trade the, hey, what if we want to move Adley to, you know, first base more or DH more often?
You're not getting Dalton rushing for, you know, Richard Lovelady. You know, it's not going to happen.
Damn, that was the dream. So I mentioned the Orioles there. Second segment here, we're going to go around the AL East. But Ben, we're going to let you go for that one. Thanks so much for doing this, man.
My pleasure. Thank you both. Good luck with the show.
Thank you.
I expect a trade proposal from you in the next like 5 minutes as you're walking home
or whatever. I'm on it. Don't worry.
All right. Thanks so much, Ben.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks to Ben Nicholson-Smith for doing that first segment with us. We're going to go just two of us now. This is how it's going to be, Julia. We'll have guests on the show, but the bulk is you and I now.
I love it. It's very nice to have guests, but it is kind of like a, you know how like when you have guests over your place and then everyone leaves and is like, oh, we can relax now?
Yes.
I love Ben. This is nice too, you know?
This is nice too, yeah. Also, I'm 3 summers of doing the 2-hour solo with only guests.
Ooh.
It'll be nice to, I mean, it's going to be very nice to have you on anyway, but like, oh, a guest no-showed. Oh, this interview got cut short. Right. I don't have to talk to myself for 20 minutes at a time.
Yeah, I did want to ask you just on air, on the record, if you will, what was it like to talk to yourself for 3 years?
It's mostly fine. You know, I'm long-winded anyway, and then everything gets to take a Blake tone. The hardest part is like, and we have a text line, obviously, that people can text in, and that helps. Ahmed will help, you know, drop some text in the Google Doc that I work off of and stuff like that. But the couple times where it was really tough is there were a couple days where I was sick. And so my voice was barely hanging on as it is. And then you've got 2 hours and then you're hoping like that day, I'm like, I'm booking the most long-winded guests that I have in the Rolodex. And then one note shows like, I got 20 minutes and I have to just be like, sorry, audience, give me 1 second. I have to sneeze and there's nothing to do. Whereas I could just kick it to you now. I could just wave to you that you got to start talking because I got to sneeze. So that'll be your sneeze guard.
And listen, you seldom sneeze just once, right?
I have experienced almost never
that. So I'm sure those were long pauses, especially for radio.
I'll be happy to not do that anymore. I'll also be very happy if the Toronto Blue Jays have a good season. I think we're headed for a really interesting season regardless, because if things go well, people will be excited. Obviously, we don't need to explain what covering a good team is like. It's fun. Oh, yeah. It's way better than covering a bad one. However, if things don't go that well, the two homegrown stars are free agents. The president of the team is on a lame duck contract, and the GM only has 1 more year. So it will at least get interesting. Let's play out the scenario where things go well. So Fangraphs has the Blue Jays projected for 83 wins. Pecota at Baseball Prospectus has them for 85. You look around at some of the pundits picking. They're not on a lot of playoff lists, but they're on a lot of like honorable mention in the mix. The reality about the American League is that everyone seems to agree that the White Sox will be irredeemably bad. the Angels and the Athletics will be garden variety bad. And then everyone else is just like about the same. It's a weird one. How do you feel the big picture about the Jays? If we're setting the, and this is a low bar given where we've been the last couple of years, but let's set the bar at, they got to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I feel like it's possible, which is pretty unbelievable to think, you know, even when the, when spring sort of started, I was kind of down on that possibility. But yeah, you look at the American League, there isn't really a ton to point to say, okay, this is going to be a runaway team sort of thing. Obviously, the Yankees are always dangerous. The Red Sox added a bunch in the off season, but you know, you lose Juan Soto, you lose Gerrit Cole for the season, and then all of a sudden the Yankees look more human, more reachable, perhaps. And I know that the Red Sox are like the sexy pick right now, but they have their injuries as well, and there are at least a few question marks around that team, not just on the pitching side, but, you know, second base. Who's going to play second base for them? Is Christian Campbell actually going to stick and just, you know, have a year? And I don't know. There are questions to answer as well. The Orioles don't look as strong as they did last year. I don't know, Blake. How do you feel when you look at sort of the scenario right now?
Yeah, it feels very 50-50, which feels like a cop-out, but also when every team is projected to win like 83 games, it doesn't actually feel like a cop-out. It feels like there is just like good parity. And a couple weeks ago, I would have had the Blue Jays on the lower end of the AL East, especially they have a very, very difficult opening schedule for the first month of the season. It's one of the most difficult months by opponent strength of schedule, opponent projected record. It's one of the toughest months any team will play in Major League Baseball this season. However, you have five series against division opponents that are starting the season a little banged up. You've got the Orioles twice early, and they obviously have a couple injuries, including Gunnar Henderson right now. You've got the Red Sox twice in the opening month. We'll see what their rotation looks like. You've got the Yankees once. I don't know that there's a soft spot when your National League opponents out of the gate are like the Mets and the Braves. That's a that's a tough one. But yeah, I think it does help a little bit that some of these teams, especially early on that you're playing against, that you're going to be competing with, the Jays, even though they do have Dalton Varsho out and a couple of relievers, are pretty safely the healthiest team in the AL East, other than maybe the Rays, who really only had Ha-Seong Kim on the IL until Shane McClanahan had the nerve impingement the other day, which looked way worse. I thought his arm was like falling off when he threw that pitch. So yeah, the Orioles, Yankees, and Red Sox all have pretty serious injury questions heading into the year. So let's go into some of those teams. Let's whip around the AL East.
Sure.
As a reminder, I just said the Blue Jays are projected to win between 83 and 85 games, depending on which model you look at. Last 3 years, the cutoffs for the final wildcard spot were 86 wins, 89 wins, 86 wins. So we can safely say you need 86 at a minimum. You probably want 89 to feel good about your chances. And those projection systems have all of the other AL East teams in that same range. Orioles 83 to 87, Yankees 85 to 86, Red Sox 80 to 85. They've got kind of the bottom
so
drops out. Rays 82 to 83, which I think that's been their projection every year for the entire history of the franchise. We'll pick how we're going to start this way. Who is the American League East team you would be most concerned about or most you think is the strongest at this point, the biggest threat to the Toronto Blue Jays?
Well, that's a tough one, isn't it? I think we can go with the safe answer with the World Series team here, which is the New York Yankees. And I understand that Gerrit Cole is a huge loss. And it's not just him, right? It's Luis Gil. It's Giancarlo Stanton, who's starting the season on the IL. DJ LeMahieu is not healthy
now. Clark Schmidt in the rotation as well.
That rotation is so banged up that they had to go and get Ryan Yarbrough. So it really gives you a sense of where the Yankees are when it comes to pitching. But
the rotation is so banged up that Marcus Stroman started spring training making noise about not wanting to move to the bullpen, and now he's their number three starter.
That's pretty wild, and he couldn't be happier about it, right?
I'm sure he's thrilled.
You listen to his post game interviews, and that is just a happy guy. Got what he wanted. It, obviously, you know, not how he would have wanted it. I'm sure that Stroman, the competitor that he is, he would have wanted to get this spot, to earn this spot with the rest of the rotation healthy. But here we are, but it's still a very dangerous lineup. And if they can cobble something together with the rotation, they should still be in a pretty good position, Blake. Do you agree with my pick that the Yankees are still the team to fear here?
I would probably have the Orioles ahead just like there's just so much young talent that like Adley Rutschman's going to be better, but their rotation is injured, and also just like it's an army of like just a guy. It's like, yeah, he's not bad. He's just a guy, though. Whereas the Yankees, if they were to get healthy, you have Carlos Rodon and Max Fried. You get Luis Gil back midseason, Clark Schmidt's back at some point. You actually like really like these guys, you know, especially the Rodon Fried part at the top. But yeah, the Yankees, it's hard to argue with the lineup. Like without LeMahieu and Stanton, their lineup still goes seven deep. Where like Austin Wells, a lefty catcher being the leadoff guy, is such a like weird lineup construction thing. And I dig it. And then they go Judge, Bellinger, Goldschmidt, Jazz Chisholm, who is going to be really good. I think, you know, obviously last year there was a lot of up and down and injury right away. And then they go, they're projected to go 6-7 or somewhere in the bottom third of the lineup. Anthony Volpe and Jason Dominguez, who, you know, we'll see if Jason Dominguez stays healthy. We'll see what Volpe, you know, what he ends up being once the kind of Yankees prospect hype wears off.
Yep.
But that's two guys that not only project as pretty good and very young and gives you some upside, it also gives the Yankees, with those two and Jazz Chisholm, like the bottom part of that lineup is going to have some speed too.
Right on.
And for years, the Yankees have been like walking homer. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to be, I think, a little more dynamic, a little more difficult to play against because they're going to be able to beat you a couple different ways offensively.
It does add some layers to that offense, which is something that the Yankees had been missing. You know, when you look at a lineup that was pretty much dominated by guys like Stanton and LeMahieu and even Judge, who, you know, is good at everything, but you wouldn't really consider speed to be one of his main attributes here, more of a power guy for sure. But this looks like a pretty solid lineup to me. I mean, the projected lineup has Ball, Goldschmidt heating cleanup. I don't know about that.
I don't think he caught up to a fastball all spring training, so there's maybe some concern there.
You kind of don't know what you're going to get with Goldschmidt. Last year was pretty divided for him. You know, terrible first half. He seemed to figure something out and get back to what's made him good a little bit more in the latter part of the season. It's not like this is a lineup without any holes, but when you kind of include the fact that the rotation is not going to be as dominant as what we have seen in past years, at least to start the season, it does, I guess, give the Blue Jays and the rest of the AL East some flaws to sort of exploit here.
Yeah, the lineup is scary. Paul Goldschmidt's at least going to mash lefties still. He'll probably do that until he's 50 years old. But yeah, Stroman saved his rotation spot. I like Will Warren, but Will Warren, who was supposed to start at AAA, is now in the rotation. And Carlos Carrasco got a 5.64 ERA last year and a 6.80 the year before that, and made the opening day rotation. And to your point, that started this all off. Look, the Jays front office is not infallible, but they decided Ryan Yarbrough was not as good as Jacob Barnes and Richard Lovelady. And the Yankees were like, we need that guy desperately. He just got cut from a division rival. We'll pay him $2 million. We need the length in here. We should also say they have five relievers on the IL as well. So they are, you know, not that, Scott Efros is changing everything, but Jake Cousins, Ian Hamilton, Jonathan Loaisia, like they've got names on the IL there. Orioles also pretty banged up here. Five starters on the injured list for them as well to start the season, including Grayson Rodriguez, which is, you know, that's the upside loss there. Trevor Rogers, who they acquired at the deadline last year, Kyle Bradish, Tyler Wells, all those guys on the IL. And Gunnar Henderson is going to start the season on the IL with a strained intercostal as well. Am I giving the Orioles too, when I say the Orioles are the team I'm most afraid of, am I being too, like, prospect anchored still and projecting forward for too many of their young hitters too much?
I don't think so. I think, number one, even without Gunnar Henderson, the Orioles can out hit pretty much every team in the American League. I believe they were second in the AL in home runs and OPS last year. The Yankees were first, and then there were the Orioles. So there's that. They can definitely hold their own offensively, even without Henderson in place, the rotation does look suspect. And, you know, you look at Zach Eflin's year last year, he had a pretty good season with the Rays. It's just pretty fascinating that, you know, you have Corbin Burnes last year and then you move on to Zach Eflin. It doesn't necessarily breed any extra confidence, let's put it like that, for Baltimore. But the bullpen is looking really, really good. And so if they can have a somewhat solid rotation, they should be okay, Blake. I just don't see this iteration of the Orioles being a better team than the one that won, what was it, 100-something games a couple years ago. I don't see this team being better than that. And that's maybe why I still have them, say, in second place here.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think it'll be another year where they're looking for a Corbin Burnes type at the trade deadline. Yeah. And you know, Kobe Mayo, who, just ask him. He has nothing left to show at AAA. You know, that'll get dangled as a trade. They had to go inside old friend Kyle Gibson, who I think has to start in minor league camp to stretch out. But, you know, they spent the Corbin Burnes money on Charlie Morton, Tomoyuki Sugano, and Kyle Gibson. And I think I would rather have Corbin Burnes than those three guys, even with depth as an issue, right?
Yeah, and I'm also curious to hear from you what you thought of bringing in those veteran guys. You don't really know where you're going to get from Sugano, especially. He has not pitched a single inning in North America yet. Very, very successful career, obviously, in Japan. But he comes in, he's a little bit up there in age, had some good starts in the spring, and then just got beat around by the Yankees at one point. So a big question mark, I would say, for that rotation. And Charlie Morton as well. Obviously, you rely on the veterans to anchor that rotation, but what is the level of certainty with guys like that?
Yeah, it's tough because we tend to think vet guys are more, there's more certainty, right? There's more, even if the ceiling's not as high, you have a higher floor there. But they also come with as much injury risk as anyone else. And Charlie Morton's not coming with the injury risk of, well, he throws 102 with nasty spin, so his arm's going to fall off. But it's, well, he's going to be 42 years old by the end of the season and no one else is pitching that old.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and like, I don't know. It's a... I guess that's why you go out and get a Kyle Gibson, and they also have Albert Suarez in the bullpen, who gave them some length last year. But yeah, I think there are question marks. Like I said, I think they're going to be a team that is once again looking for pitching at the trade deadline. And it's interesting that like they've done such a good job rebuilding and building a farm system and stuff like that. But it remains that like most of their guys who are close to the majors are on the position player side.
Right on.
You know, again, like Kobe Mayo just sitting there waiting for his turn. And I don't think, you know, I don't think their top prospects are knocking at the door on the pitching side. Like I think Luis De Leon is their like best pitching prospect who might start at double A or higher this year. I obviously we don't have those assignments and stuff like that yet. But like their triple A stuff has some guys, but no one on even like a Cade Povich level. So that'll be interesting to see play out. I don't I do think Adley's going to be better, and then that goes a long way when you have two MVP level guys once Gunnar's healthy and stuff like that. Jackson Holliday's a weird one too. Like
I was gonna ask you about
yeah
it.
So first of all, he turned orange
when it happens.
I think it was a Photoshop error when they released the new jerseys, but he looks very orange. It's also interesting. So I joked earlier about doing fantasy drafts, but I do find that look, fantasy baseball is not the same as real baseball.
Right.
Jackson Holliday could be, fantasy baseball is a 1-year window a lot of the time. You only care about certain counting stats and things like that. It's not real baseball in terms of valuing players. But in fantasy baseball, prospects usually get overdrafted. People are too hungry for prospects and have too high expectations. And basically no one's touching Jackson Holliday.
Really?
Which is pretty fascinating. Like he's a late round guy only, even in the fantasy world where those guys are prospect hounds. So it was interesting to see like as a measure of, I guess, like public belief in him. He just like I expected him to go higher than he was. So maybe people saw the season last year where he hit 189 and didn't really add anything from counting stats perspective. But I mean, if from real baseball terms, I'm still betting everything that he's going to be a very, very good player.
Right. It's I'd be curious to see. Tried to look up really quickly here just what his projected war would be, and I don't know how much that goes into fantasy baseball because like you said, Blake, it's so different, right? It's obviously a different world when you're playing fantasy and the real value of players. But and he's projected to bat ninth. So, you know, the Orioles obviously also want to see a little bit more from him before he can actually come in and be the impact player that they want him to be. But it is interesting to me that just the perception of him has changed so much. Because, sure, he struggled last year, and there's no arguing with that. But this is a guy who was expected to be the next big star. And it kind of brings me back a little bit, obviously completely different discussions, but it does bring me back a little bit to Bo Bichette and how quickly the discourse around Bo changed when he had his down year last year, right? Guy who wins the batting title twice in a row, or sorry, leads the league in hits 2 years in a row, almost got a third one in there, has a down year, injured, and then just people are so down on him. And it seems like... Jackson Holliday, in his own way, is going through that a little bit right now, where there was struggle. There was definitely the learning curve that you kind of expect from prospects and all of that. But just how quickly, right, that that vision can change.
Yeah, and that's going to be, you know, the story of at least the early part of the Red Sox season as well. So we'll pivot to them. You mentioned earlier, Christian Campbell is going to, we think, start at second base opening day and get some run there. They have guys who are close to the majors in Marcello Meyer and Roman Anthony. But this is a team that at least for right now is going to rely on a prospect in a pretty big spot. They are also a team that has a whole bunch of injuries, because that's what we're doing right now. Brian Baio, Cutter Crawford, Lucas Giolito, Patrick Sandoval, all on the aisle on the pitcher side, and Masataka Yoshida, which, who knows, maybe that would have resolved the second base thing, because if Yoshida's healthy, he DHs a little bit more. Willy Abreu plays some second. Who knows how that all shakes out. But yeah, right now, Christian Campbell going to be going to get some opportunity. Maybe David Hamilton mixes in there or something, but always fun to see prospects. You just hope, from a Blue Jays perspective, you hope, yeah, Christian Campbell has a little Jackson Holliday stumble.
Let me ask you this. How did you feel about the Alex Bregman signing?
If I'm the Red Sox, love it. I think it's a great, I think it's a great fit. I think he's going to play ping pong with the monster. I think it's, you know, 3 years, 120 with the multiple opt-outs skews pretty player friendly. Like if he has a big year to walk, but yeah, I mean, even if he has a great year and walks, you get 1 year of Alex Bregman at 30 mil in a park that really suits him. He came along in the second half of last year to where I don't think he was quite as bad as his final stat line suggested.
Right.
I don't know if he's going to be like a 8-win MVP kind of guy anymore. But yeah, I think you're pretty happy with that. It'll be interesting to see how they manage the him endeavors and Cassis positionally and stuff like that. But from a short-term perspective, yeah, unfortunately, I loved it.
it will be interesting. And then, you know, Devers obviously would like to play third. I don't see that happening a whole lot.
He should play it better if he wants to play it, is what I would say, because Bregman's one of the best to do it.
But, you know, even with the injuries, Blake, just looking at this rotation, it looks pretty good.
Garrett Crochet, Tanner Houck, Walker Buehler as a top three is pretty good. And I don't think, you know, we're not expecting season-long absences for a Brian Baio or a Cutter Crawford. So those are, even Lucas Giolito, it's a hamstring strain. Those things can be wonky, but none of those guys underwent Tommy John or brace procedure or anything like that. Short-term, Richard Fitz and Sean Newcomb being in the rotation is not ideal. And I think I think other than Toronto, their bullpen is probably the one I'm least confident in.
Right on. When you have Aroldis Chapman as your projected closer.
Yeah. And like Liam Hendricks and Justin Slatton are there, but like it's not a super deep bullpen in terms of established names either. Right. So I think they're going to maybe they got to hope Crochet, Houck, and Buehler is as good in practice as it is on paper. It looks pretty good on paper.
They do look, though, the Red Sox do look like they could make a legitimate run for the postseason this year.
This is the thing. There's four teams in the division. I don't know about the Rays, but
yeah. But you can never count them out.
Yeah, and like to wrap up here, because we're running a little bit long, but the Rays, there is this element of you can never count them out. And there are, weirdly, because they've had 30 guys on their 60-day IL for the last couple seasons, they're one of the more healthy teams. McClanahan's going to be on the IL, but they avoided some disaster there. They actually have 5 actual starting pitchers this year.
The rotation's good.
Not bulk guys and openers and things like that. And their bullpen isn't special on paper, but I just like... I have this deference to the Rays that, like, they'll figure out the bullpen guys.
Yes. Yeah, you can always count on them to figure it out. There's even, you know, a touch of Rays in the fact that Richard Lovelady is with the Blue Jays right now. He got claimed off waivers last year, and something about that organization did help him figure some stuff out and make him somewhat of a solid reliever in the major leagues, which is something that I don't think anyone saw coming, even within the Rays. You know, if you asked Rays analysts and such, and so. Yeah, obviously, you know, questions around the lineup. It'll be cool to see Danny Jansen, I guess.
Yeah, Junior Caminero is one of the, like, most fun young players.
Right on.
We'll see if...
There's some pop there in that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, if Chris Morel can figure it out a little bit, like... There's also the weird element of, like, we're used to Tropicana Field, but they're going to play at Steinbrenner Field.
Right on.
So, like, what does that look like? What does it play like? Danny Jansen as a dead pull in the air hitter, does that end up being like a really good environment for him? And he pops 25. Does it end up being not a friendly environment? They'll be a fascinating team. They're a weird one to be. So, like, I run into this where I'm like, I'll be deferring to the Rays. I'll assume they'll figure it out. Yep. They'll be able to find value. And then you look at some of the, like, projection models, and 8 of their 9 starters and 2 of their 4 bench guys are all projected to be league average bats or better. So, like, statistically, they project as a team to just figure it out too. Nobody's a superstar, but, like, hey, Yandy Diaz is going to be a little better. Caminero is really fun. Even Curtis Mead had a really good, I thought we were done with Curtis Mead, but he had a really good spring too. So, I don't know. I think they're, like, on paper, they're the weakest of the 5 teams, right. But I just, like, assume they'll figure it out.
Yeah, that's been a fair assumption over the years, Blake. And this division never ceases to impress and surprise, right? It's just you really never know what you were going to get.
It's annoying because you also get... You also get, like, and not to do, like, oh, woe is us and, like, oh, the realignment, the Jays could have been in the Central, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But, like, particularly right now, speaking from an acute sense, there is, like, an AL East tax because the White Sox are expected to be so bad. And if they win 40 games again like they did last year, well, the worst team in the AL Central handed out 40 wins.
Yep.
The worst team in the AL East is going to probably at worst be 500.
Yeah.
Like, the Jays pulled the plug last year, so they finished worse than 500. But, like, all of those teams, I read the projections out earlier, none of them were projected to win fewer than 82 games.
And, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that it's annoying because it's even, you know, it does make our jobs more interesting. I will put it that way. But just so difficult to project. And then you add the injuries, and then you add the guys who walked in free agency, and all of a sudden it does look, I guess, more balanced than it has in recent years, but that's also not necessarily to the Blue Jays' benefit.
Yeah, we'll see. And they're in a spot where you got to hit the ground running because, look, all 162 games are created equal, but for the Toronto Blue Jays, if you are facing down some really big existential organizational decisions that you have to make a call on by July 31st, you better stack some wins early in the year. Those August wins might not count as much as these April, May, June, July wins for organizational direction. We are going to break this all down more on Thursday. We'll go through the opening day lineup. We'll focus a little bit more. We talked about the fringe guys today and the rest of the AL East. We'll focus on the actual 26 guys who are going to make up the starting 9, the 5 rotation. We'll go a little deeper on the Orioles, who the Blue Jays will see opening day. That'll be 11 to 12 on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet 360, and Sportsnet Plus. And then again, April 15th will be our first official episode. We will officially welcome you, jersey,
yes,
banner, all that stuff. Yeah, but for now, thanks for doing this, Julia.
Thank you. This is a lot of fun. I can't wait to officially get started.
It will be great. So again, Thursday, we're back for opening day, 11 to 12, and then April 15th will be the first episode. This has been, I don't know, a spring training, shake the rust off for me because I've been talking about basketball prospects for the last couple months. Episode of Jays Talk Plus. We will talk to you Thursday for opening day.